From NPR News, you're listening to the best of Weekends and All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program on Saturdays and Sundays. This episode, neocons versus realists. Middle East democracy good for America or good for Iran? Also, after taking on the teachers' unions in Washington, D.C., Michelle Rhee's going national. Plus, what happens when a quiet academic toiling in obscurity becomes the target of a Glenn Beck campaign? Let's just say it's not pleasant. And later, more three-minute fiction stories and the real-life story of a hardened war correspondent who faced his biggest struggle at home with his schizophrenic son. Plus, and you can't miss this one, Charles Bradley was a short-order cook most of his life, drifting from town to town. And now, at age 62, his golden-voiced soul sound has finally been discovered. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Now, in recent days, some former staffers of President George W. Bush have argued that the so-called freedom agenda pushed by the administration is now starting to bear fruit across the Middle East. Elliot Abrams, the Deputy National Security Advisor for Global Democracy Strategy under President Bush, is one of those people who's been making that case.
What the president began to say after 9/11 was that there was no special exception for the Arab world, that we had supported stability in the Middle East at the cost of liberty, and that we weren't going to get stability either. And of course, this is at a time when most of these regimes look completely stable. So the point I was making is that he had it right in saying that these were not as stable as they appeared to be.
Do you acknowledge that there could be a messy period? There could be a long period even where many of these countries won't just have deposed pro-American leaders, but may actively become anti-American?
I don't think they'll become anti-American, but messy period, sure. I mean, every country that has become a democracy has had a messy period. The thing is, we're in favor of democracy. We're Americans. We're supposed to be supporting democracy, not just at home. We believe in it for every people around the world. How could we not be thrilled and excited by what we're seeing in the streets of Tripoli and Manama and Cairo and other places?
What would you propose the United States do? I mean, you say that, that the United States should support this and should actively support it, but how?
We have a number of ways of helping countries in transition through AID, through the National Endowment for Democracy, through the Republican and Democratic Party Institutes, and through a lot of NGOs, training people who are setting up a party for the first time in how do you organize a party? How do you communicate with voters? How do you reach out? We know a little bit about this. So do the Europeans. So especially do people who've been through it a lot more recently than we have, the Poles, the Czechs, the Chileans. And we ought to try to organize and make sure that people, especially with more recent experience, get over to these new democracies or countries trying to be democracies and give them whatever help they can.
Many, many people, fairly or unfairly, argue that, you know, the Bush administration pushed the freedom agenda at the point of a gun, and Iraq and Afghanistan were sort of their primary examples. If, in fact, this is the result of an idea or values that were proposed by President George W. Bush, going all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, what happens now? I mean, should the United States actively back other movements in other Middle Eastern countries?
I'm not arguing that the United States should have a policy of overthrowing everybody's government. We had nothing to do with the uprising in Tunisia or in Egypt or in Libya. These are spontaneous moves on the part of the people of those countries. The question really is, when they make that move, how do we react? And I'm just suggesting that we should react favorably. We should react by saying, you know, it's your country, but anything we can do to help freedom expand, we want to do. We believe in it, and it's in our interests.
In a few moments, we're going to hear from Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett. They are former National Security Council staffers under President Bill Clinton. They argue that Iran will be the big winner out of all these uprisings throughout the Middle East. Do they have a point?
I think they have half a point. I think there are two sides to this coin. And one side is there's turmoil, you know, there's instability. That offers opportunities for people who like to sow instability, who are going to support extremist groups. There's no question that there are many more opportunities for Iran, let's say in Egypt or Tunisia now, than there were when they were dictatorships. But the other side of the coin is that Iran is a dictatorship. Nobody in the streets of Tunisia or Libya is asking for ayatollahs and stolen elections and revolutionary guards throwing you in prison. They're asking for freedom. And I think that in a matter of 1 year, 2 years, this will look very different for Iran because the Middle East is turning democratic. I think, therefore, that it hurts Iran, particularly in the area of soft power, reputation, influence that's so important.
That's Elliot Abrams. He was a foreign policy advisor to President Reagan and President George W. Bush. He's now a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Elliot Abrams, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's been one of the loudest supporters of the uprisings across the Arab world. It's no secret he regards certain Arab leaders as rivals and proxies of the United States. And Flint Leverett and his wife Hillary Mann Leverett, both former National Security Council staffers, argue that Iran has much to gain from the changes taking place in the Middle East.
Their influence has really been on the rise, particularly since the U.S. invasion of Iraq, mm-hmm. which, you know, one of the most important things it did was essentially liberate the Shia in Iraq. Iran was able to really use what we call its soft power, its ability to exert influence throughout the region. It was able to use, in particular, the liberation of the Shia to take its policy that it's had really since the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran and almost put it on steroids, to use the influence it could use in Iraq, to use it more broadly throughout the Middle East. They are really in a position to take advantage of, to be open to, people who are newly becoming empowered in their states to hear their grievances and to tap into their grievances.
And of course, there was no great love between the Iranian government and some of these Arab leaders like Mubarak, like Abdullah in Saudi Arabia, and Gaddafi in Libya.
I think that's right. The Islamic Republic is very, very confident in the proposition that any government in the Arab world which becomes at all more representative of its people's values, beliefs, concerns, preferences, interests, any government in the Arab world that becomes more representative of its own people will, first of all, by definition, become less enthusiastic about strategic cooperation with the United States and Israel, and that's a plus for Iran. Any government like that will also become, in some ways, more receptive to the Iranian message of resistance to U.S. and Israeli hegemony in the region. That's a message that doesn't just go to Shia. It goes throughout the region and has enormous appeal on the Sunni Arab street.
Ahmadinejad is encouraging these protests all over the Middle East and these uprisings. And, of course, he faced a pretty significant turmoil in 2009 on the streets of Tehran and other cities in Iran. I mean, wouldn't Iranians find that somewhat rich coming from a man who essentially crushed an uprising in his own country?
Well, I think that some Iranians might find that, as you say, rich. But I think that the reality is that the Green Movement, as it emerged, did not represent a majority of the Iranian population, and that a majority of Iranians actually living in Iran still like the idea of an Islamic Republic, even if some of them want that Islamic Republic to evolve in some ways or be different in some ways than it is today. The majority of Iranians still buy into the idea of an Islamic Republic.
And there's a really important distinction that I think is routinely missed in Washington, that the Islamic Republic, the system in the Islamic Republic, it belongs to the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran, warts and all, flaws and all. It's their system. It's an independent system. Its foreign policy, its policy decisions are independent. So with all of the criticisms that you have within the Islamic Republic, and for all the many of the people inside Iran want the system to evolve in different ways, they want it to be their system, and they want it to continue to be the Islamic Republic. That is completely different, completely the opposite of nearly every other state in the region.
What if what emerges in the Middle East, throughout the Middle East, is a collection of essentially non-aligned states, you know, governments with no interest in serving as proxies or pawns, you know, in a strategic struggle between the U.S. And Iran?
If that happens, and I think we are very much headed in that direction already, the United States is going to have to get serious about a skill that it has really allowed to atrophy for several decades which I would call classical diplomacy, the ability to align with multiple states, you know, find areas of common interest, play those to build relationships, and manage the areas where there are going to be very, very strong disagreements. This is not the way the United States is used to dealing with the Middle East. We really function as a kind of hegemonic power in this region. That is just not going to be tenable anymore, and the United States is going to have a much more creative, adaptive, strategically grounded foreign policy in this part of the world than it's had for a long time.
That's Flint Leverett and Hillary Mann Leverett. He teaches at Penn State and is a fellow at the New America Foundation. She teaches at Yale and American University. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, it's not only Republicans like Scott Walker and Chris Christie who are challenging unions. When it comes to teachers' unions, it's increasingly Democrats, people like Michelle Rhee. She was the head of the Washington, D.C. school district for about 3 years. And during that time, she fired hundreds of teachers who she said were underperforming. And she also tied pay increases to merit, not to tenure. Now, she's heading up an education advocacy group based out of Sacramento. It's called Students First. And with it, she hopes to create a powerful lobby to push for education reform.
Over the last 30 years, the education policy has been driven in this country by lots of special interest groups, including the teachers' union. And I think that one of the missing pieces is that there is no organized national interest group that has the heft that the unions and other groups do who are advocating on behalf of children. So we're going to be doing a few things. One, we're going to be working in a few anchor states where the governor and legislature are interested in adopting all or a significant percentage of our policy agenda. We're also going to be working across the country on certain agenda items as well. So, for example, the first one that we are going to be launching is to try to get rid of LIFO provisions. That's last in, first out. When layoffs are conducted in this country of teachers, they are conducted by seniority, which means that the most junior teachers are let go first.
Even if they're the best.
Even if they're the best. And these, what we call LIFO provisions, make absolutely no sense for children, because the research shows that, number one, you end up firing some of your best teachers. Number two, you have to fire more teachers because the junior teachers get paid the least, so you have to fire more of them to cover the budget deficit. And then three, that it disproportionately negatively impacts the lowest performing schools, the highest need schools, because they have the largest number of new teachers. So the policies are absolutely not good for children. We understand that they may serve some adult interests, but that is a policy that nationwide we are going to have a heavy campaign to try to change.
Michelle Rhee, I understand that Students First will support the idea of vouchers for students who choose to attend private schools. You have long been an advocate for strong public education. Obviously, that's what you're known for. I wonder if that position is a form of resignation in a way that in your view, elements of public education will not be salvageable.
No, not at all. When I was the chancellor of the Washington, D.C. public school system, my purview and my day-to-day was focused on building a great public school system, traditional public school system. And, you know, I'm a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat, so when I was not running the school district, I was not in favor of vouchers. I thought these, you know, public money going to private institutions, not a good thing. I changed my mind when I actually came to D.C. because I was faced with a situation where mothers who lived in Anacostia, which was the poorest part of town, would come to me, and they had done everything that you would want a mother to do. So they research their neighborhood school, and they find out that it's failing. Then they apply through the lottery process for one of the, you know, few schools that we had in the district that was performing well, and they didn't win a seat in the lottery. And then those mothers would come to me and say, what am I supposed to do now? And if I did not have a place for their children at one of my public schools that I would feel comfortable sending my own children to, then who am I to deny that parent a $7,500 voucher, which, by the way, is $1,500 less than we were spending per child in the public schools, so that they could attend a good, for example, parochial school, Catholic school. My job is to make sure that kids are getting a great education. And if I can't provide that for them today, but they can get it somewhere else, then that's got to be our goal, not preserving the system, but making sure that kids are getting a great education.
Mayor Kevin Johnson in Sacramento boasted that out of all the mayors in the country, he was the one that managed to get you to base your organization in his city. He had a little bit of an advantage.
He had a little bit of an advantage because we are going to get married. but he gave me a really good sell. And Sacramento, under his leadership, is really an up-and-coming city. My staff and I just took a visit out to Sacramento last weekend. I got them excited about moving out there, so we're looking forward to it.
That's Michelle Rhee. She's the former chancellor of the District of Columbia school system and now heads Students First. It's an education advocacy group based out of Sacramento, California. Michelle Rhee, thank you.
Thank you.
Imagine toiling away on obscure academic work your whole life, and then, in a matter of minutes, not just becoming famous, but becoming infamous. Welcome to Francis Fox Piven's life these past 3 months. On his TV and radio programs, Glenn Beck identified her as the source of a conspiracy happening in real time, a conspiracy to destroy American capitalism.
Let me introduce you to the people who you would say are fundamentally responsible for the unsustainability and possible collapse of our economic system. They're really two people I've been telling you for a while. There they are, Cloward and Piven.
Cloward is Richard Cloward. He was Francis Fox Piven's husband and collaborator up until his death in 2001. Glenn Beck calls Francis Fox Piven one of the 9 most dangerous people in America, and here's how she describes herself.
I'm 78 years old. I'm about 5'6". My hair is partly gray. I'm quite thin.
Piven teaches sociology at the City University of New York. Now, outside her field, very few people had ever heard of Francis Fox Piven. And late last year, some of her students came around to her office to say they'd seen her picture on the Fox News Channel.
And they said that Glenn Beck thinks that you are a plotter, a conspirator, that you have a plan to take down American capitalism. And then they giggled because my students think that's very funny.
So she tuned in and found herself right at the heart of one of Glenn Beck's trademark chalkboard diagrams.
And there I was with my longtime but now dead collaborator right at the trunk of the Tree of Revolution.
The roots of the Tree of Radicalism and Revolution. It's Saul Alinsky. It's Woodrow Wilson.
And there were branches going off. And one branch went to SDS, Students for a Democratic Society.
Wade Raskey, right up the tree. Dale,
and another went to George Soros.
Jeff Jones, right up the tree.
And another went to Barack Obama.
Cloward and Piven.
So what did Francis Fox Piven do to be called an enemy of the Constitution? Well, she and her husband wrote a plan that they believed could solve the welfare problem. It appeared back in 1966 in The Nation magazine.
We had monitored the welfare program on the Lower East Side of New York, and we knew that there were many occasions in which people were turned away for no good reason.
People eligible for welfare weren't a part of the program because getting it was actually very bureaucratic and complicated. So Piven and her husband proposed that activists and social workers and lawyers help all those people who were eligible for welfare to apply. And that would create a bit of a mess. It would force the government, they theorized, to reform the system and make it less bureaucratic. But Glenn Beck interpreted their plan somewhat differently.
Overwhelm the system and bring about the fall of capitalism by overloading the government bureaucracy with impossible demands and bring on economic collapse.
On and on he went, week after week, hammering away at Cloward and Piven. From a single article written 45 years ago, he imagined a vast conspiracy to overthrow the American financial system. And Beck's followers became enraged. Piven started to get letters and emails and phone messages.
May cancer overtake you soon. And some things they said, which I don't think I can repeat on NPR. After hundreds of death threats, I began to be wary. You know, I actually went to the state police. I went to the FBI.
Glenn Beck never obviously called for direct violence against you, but do you think that that he's responsible for some of the violent language that's been directed towards you?
Oh, absolutely. It's a lunatic story, but it's a story that nevertheless is clear. This woman is somehow responsible for the upsetting changes in your small town where the factory closed down. I don't blame them for being upset. It is upsetting, but I blame Glenn Beck for telling them a factually untrue, crazy story about why those changes occurred.
The story of Frances Fox Piven. Up until a few months ago, she was an obscure academic. She spoke with us from New York. On a snowy February day in 2002, the well-known British journalist Petra Coburn was in Kabul in Afghanistan covering the fall of the Taliban. That day, he picked up his satellite phone to call his wife Jan. She was back in Canterbury, England. Even over that shaky and hollow telephone line, Jan sounded anxious.
I could not make out the details, but I grasped that Henry, our 20-year-old son, had nearly died when he swam New Haven Estuary, fully clothed, and was rescued by fishermen as he left the near-freezing water. The fishermen feared he might be suffering from hypothermia and took him to a general hospital in Brighton. The police had been called. They had decided that Henry was a danger to himself, and he was now in a mental hospital.
The next morning, Patrick Coburn and his driver braved the treacherous Kabul Gorge. Just a few weeks earlier, four journalists had been killed by Taliban militiamen in that same place. And he went through there and made his way to Islamabad in Pakistan to catch the first flight home. His son Henry was diagnosed with schizophrenia. The story of what happened next, Henry's experiences in and out of mental hospitals for 8 years, and how the family coped is told in a new memoir. It's called Henry's Demons, and in it, Patrick, Henry, and Jan all write alternating chapters, each from a different perspective. Patrick and Henry Coburn join me now from London. Welcome to you both.
Nice to be here.
Hello.
Patrick, let's start at the beginning. You had just seen Henry a few weeks earlier. This was back Christmas of 2001. Were there any signs, any signals that Henry was in trouble?
No, I didn't see any, and I've been back over it in my mind 100 times. I mean, I asked him how he was. He'd started at art college a few weeks earlier, and he said he'd never been happier in his life.
Henry, you... That night, you were found by fishermen, as we just heard, in near freezing water in an estuary. What do you remember about that night? I mean, do you remember swimming in that water?
Yeah, I felt I was sort of running away, and that people were following me. And I'm glad I crossed the estuary because I felt I was following a path, as it. And trying to sort of escape the city and get back to Canterbury.
Canterbury is where you're, of course, where you're from. You were trying to get from Brighton, the town of Brighton in southern England, to the town of Canterbury.
Yeah, it's the most I've ever walked in one day. I walked about 25 miles across the coast, and I walked by the coast, by the sea, and there was this big wall, and I thought that there were prisoners behind the wall. And it was all quite daunting. It was quite... scary.
Do you remember why you decided to swim in the water?
I felt a force sort of pulling me in. It was as if I was being beckoned into the water. I mean, I had a choice. I could have stayed out of the water, but I felt beckoned, and I got to the other side, and it was dead cold, and I could. I was quite close to death, I think.
Patrick, you by the time you arrived, Henry had already been moved to another hospital, a psychiatric hospital. Describe what he looked like when you saw him.
Well, you know, in some ways he looked the same physically, but his whole somehow everything about him had changed. He was seemed sort of frightened by what had happened. He seemed a bit sort of separate from the world.
Henry, what was going through your mind at that time? I mean, what did you think was happening to you?
I felt I was sort of changing my lifestyle. I'd given up marijuana, I'd given up tobacco, I'd given up alcohol. I thought there was something more to the world that I hadn't seen before, you know. I found it revelatory, these experiences, talking to trees and, you know, it was like a hidden world.
I'm speaking with the journalist Patrick Coburn and his son Henry. Their co-memoir is called Henry's Demons, Living with Schizophrenia, a Father and Son's Story. Henry, when you spoke to trees and when you had visions, you described seeing rings, like a wedding ring, right in front of you, and tree roots reaching out to you. I mean, that is very real to you.
It's still real. I'm never going to believe that it wasn't. It was, you know, as real as me talking now.
They weren't hallucinations?
No.
Patrick, when you go overseas now, because you obviously you're a foreign correspondent, you write for The Independent, do you have some anxiety about leaving Henry behind?
Yes, about every 5 seconds, yes. You know, I worry about it the whole time. And I try and sort of reduce the worry. But it's difficult. I mean, Henry's, you know, things are going much better now, but it's very difficult to sort of get memories out of your head. I mean, Henry feels, you know, that his life was never, he was never, close to death, or he certainly wasn't trying to commit suicide. But, and I'm sure, you know, he wasn't. But if you, you know, swim in freezing seawater, how long do people normally live there? Now, whatever Henry's intentions, there's no doubt he came close to death again and again. So, you know, I remember that. So I'm anxious, and I'm probably over-anxious, but I don't think it's probably... I suspect it's something that I'll never be able to turn the clock back on for the rest of my life.
And let me ask you, Henry, do you feel like you're cured?
Yeah.
Do you feel like you can have a normal life?
Yeah.
Tell me about your life now. You're not. You don't live in a hospital now. You live kind of on your own, right?
Yeah, by next week I should be sort of... I've got my own apartment now. It's got a front room, a bedroom, a toilet and a kitchen. It looks onto the sea. So that's, you know, that's positive.
That's Patrick Coburn and his son Henry. Their co-memoir is called Henry's Demons, Living with Schizophrenia, a Father and Son's Story. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I know. I've seen the comments on the 3-Minute Fiction page at npr.org. I've seen the questions on the 3-Minute Fiction Facebook page. You're asking, when are you going to pick a winner? Well, as many of you know, 4,000 stories came in this round, and at 3 minutes a read, that's 200 hours of reading or 8 straight days nonstop. Now, we have some help, of course, from students at NYU and the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and we're getting closer to finding the one. It's difficult, but until we do, here are some excerpts from 2 more that won a seal of approval from our judge this round, the novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
The winds moved to Atlanta about the same time that ferry got swallowed up by the marsh. I suppose that ferryman moved too. Mr. Byram was a gambler from Augusta. He arrived with all the other uppities one day, tallest man I'd ever seen. His top hat gave him the look of a factory smokestack. He was the kind of man that made babies cry. That's just what happened too. Mrs. Mazel's baby was shooting tears straight out when he got near. That kind of man you didn't look right at. Now there he was, sitting right next to the tiger lady on the slide swing, having tea. Just weeks after Mr. Byram's arrival, funny things started happening. Not funny like knock, knock. Who's there? Orange. Orange who? Aren't you glad I didn't say apple? Closed bank accounts and cats. A lot more cats. That kind of funny.
We could never weed out Bobby's true stories from his half-baked jokes, which usually started out as a tale about a friend from work and ended with his overtelling the punchline. He always said he was lucky to be second youngest, but only complained about not owning his own shoes. Yeah, me and Chano walked to school wearing the same shoes every year. You wore one shoe, I wore the other. We knew that wasn't true, but we listened through to the punchline until Poppy laughed himself to tears. During family gatherings, Poppy's love of stories told and performed through jokes and music quickly led everyone to the kitchen, where he produced all of our yummy Puerto Rican meals. Then our living room became a transformed space, infused with cuatro guitars and congas beating softly to Afro-Cuban rhythms that weaved in clave between Spanish conversations. We sang the crying salsa rhymes of Hector Lavoe.
The story's called El Llorón by Giovanni Flores of Phoenix, Arizona. And earlier, we heard The Tiger Lady by Jimmy Boyer of St. Simon's Island, Georgia. They are read by our own Leanne Hansen and Felix Contreras. To read full versions of these stories and others, go to our website, npr.org/3-Minute Fiction. And that's 3-Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. ...62-year-old Charles Bradley has a story you can hear in his voice.
Why is it so hard to make it in America?
That voice was discovered by a record executive who happened to pop into a Brooklyn nightclub about 2 years ago. And he couldn't believe that the man singing, Charles Bradley, was unknown. Because for most of his life, Charles Bradley wasn't a singer. He had to make ends meet. But after 62 years in obscurity, his debut album, No Time for Dreamin', has just been released. It's the story of his life and his struggles, and it blew us away when we first heard it.
Everybody.
What is it like to hear yourself on a record?
I just said it's been a long time coming.
A long time indeed. Charles Bradley was born in Brooklyn in 1948. One afternoon when he was a kid, his sister said she was going to the Apollo Theater to see James Brown.
And when he had those strobe lights and they had those effects lights on him, James Brown came right on the stage. And I said, oh, my God, I want to be like that.
Charles went home and practiced James Brown's signature mic swing move. He used a broom attached to a string.
I found someone.
He had a good voice, but no connections, no way to capture anyone's attention with it. So as a young man, Charles left New York and he went to Maine to find work as a short order cook.
But my music always pulling on me. And, you know, I just said, God, I want to do my music.
After almost 10 years working in the kitchen, he quit his job. He got rid of a car he couldn't afford.
And I said, now I'm free. I don't owe nobody. And I'm a hitchhiker. And I'm going to hitchhike this road till I find my opportunities.
Charles went off to hitchhike across the country.
How long must I keep going on? And I kept going, kept going. I had some hardships.
He made it out to the West Coast.
California. Then I was in Seattle, Washington, San Francisco.
And then he hitched a ride with two men all the way north.
To Canada.
But at the age of 51, Charles Bradley returned to Brooklyn and to music as well. He started doing a James Brown act in nightclubs. He was making a bit of money. He was close to his family again. Things were looking pretty good. That is, until the night Bradley's brother was shot dead.
The night before my brother got killed, I was walking through his hallway, and he grabbed me and he held me. He said, Charles, he said, bro, I love you. You always show love to me, Charles. And I said, Joe, I wish I could be something like you. He said, no, bro. Be you. You're sweet. And I love you in my heart, Charles. And he held me, and he wouldn't let me go. I said, Joe, what's wrong with you? I said, I'll see you tomorrow, bro. And I went up and got in my bed. And then my mother came knock on my door, and she said, son, what is all those policemen outside? I said, I don't know, Mom. But my bed is by the window, so I pushed the drapes out and look out. I said, oh, my God, what is this? 6 or 7 police cars, 5 trucks. This van says morgue. Your brother is gone.
Charles Bradley wrote this song, Heartaches and Pain, about his brother Joe.
Heartache and pain. It took 11 years for me to write this song.
After Joe died, Charles went into a depression. It took him a while to get back to performing, but one night, while doing his James Brown act under the stage name Black Velvet, a co-founder of the indie label Deftone Records saw him on stage, and that led to a meeting with Tom Brennick. He's a young producer and musician on the label.
You know, I was maybe 19 or 20 at the time.
And Brennick had a band, and he soon invited Charles to a rehearsal.
I was feeling good. I had a couple of drinks, and they gave me the mic. I said, just play anything as long as it's funky.
And that I remember so vividly because I was just like, oh, my God, this guy's feeling it. This guy is the real deal. He had never been himself before. He had never been encouraged to search for his own song. So maybe I was the first person to come along into Charles's life and say, Charles, you don't have one song to sing. You have like 100 songs to sing. And we spent a couple years and we wrote 10 together.
I'm just saying it's all right to dream, but work at it. Make it come to reality. Because you just sit and dream about it, it's just going to only be a dream. It took 6 or 2 years for somebody to find me. But I thank God some people never be found.
Charles Bradley, his debut album, co-written with producer Tom Brennick, is called No Time for Dreaming. Stop pacing over yonder. Wake up! You get your break. Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Petra Mayer and produced by Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brent Bachman, and Jessica Deal. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Our intern is Megan Kane. Mathoni Maturi is filling in for Rick Holter as our editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next Sunday with the best of Weekends and All Things Considered. And remember, you can hear the full version of this program on your local public radio station each Saturday and Sunday afternoon. It's got to work. Are you in up? A-